The government?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Appellant may argue.
Good morning, Your Honor. Chief Judge Stuckey, members of the court, may it please the court. I'm Lieutenant Colonel Christopher Carrier. Mr. Barry Steinberg and I represent the appellant, Specialist Jason Kolbeck. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
Your Honor, in this case, the application of Military Rule of Evidence 707 was influenced by, indeed determined by, an erroneous view of the law. That's the first point. That's the standard for an abuse of discretion. The application of the rule was disproportionate to the purposes the rule was designed to serve. That is the constitutional standard that decides the case. And he was, by this application, stripped of the power to describe the circumstances that prompted his statement. That's the language from Crane versus Kentucky that shows the prejudice. That's the standard. That's the constitutional rule. That's the prejudice in this case.
Okay, well, you have a little problem.
Sure.
The Supreme Court passed on this thing 20 years ago and said, no problem. No one has moved to amend it since. Now, the President has not moved to amend it since. The Joint Service Committee has left it alone. If there were some big lurking constitutional problem, wouldn't somebody have done something? Like maybe the highest court in the land?
So this case does not disturb the holding of Rock. The language that I was quoting there is from Sheffer and Rock both. In Sheffer at 316 and at Rock at 52, they said that the accused ought to be able to present his own version of events in his own words.
Well, don't you admit that what he wants to do in this case is prohibited by the explicit language of the rule?
Your Honor, that is probably the best reading of the rule, but it's important to consider that the reason the Air Force has not interpreted it this way, the reason that's not completely crazy, there is a point there. It's in the concurrence of Chief Judge Everett in Clark. He notes that this may not be what was meant, and if you look at the rationale that is in 2A and 2D in Sheffer.
But the rule can be read, and I would say the most logical reading of the rule prohibits what you want to do.
I think that's right, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Yes, Your Honor, I do. I think.
But does a constitutional right supersede any military rule of evidence?
It does, Your Honor, and that's where it's key to see how it is different from Sheffer. And a number of points can be made here. I'm not sure what the best point of entry is, but one point, for example, in looking carefully at what the Supreme Court was ruling on in Sheffer, they noted that sort of chiding that the CAF decision did not say what part of or what idea in the Sixth Amendment are they citing, and they said that when pressed at the Supreme Court, the appellant, said it was compulsory process. That is somebody else coming in. So this is one way I can get to the point that what was going on in Sheffer is not, I want to tell the circumstances of my statement. What was going on in Sheffer was a violation of Daubert. It was, I want to bring in the result, the opinion, I want somebody else, compulsory process. In 2D, only 2A and 2D are the parts of the Sheffer opinion that are actually the opinion of the court that really has the heart of the matter. And 2A, from pages 309 to 312, that's all about Daubert. It's another interesting thing to note that the outcome in Sheffer, I don't see how it would be any different if there had been no 707 and if it had been a Daubert case. This is not an unworkable idea. This is what goes on in federal court where you have Daubert. They don't have that rule, but I still, in federal court, I can't bring in a polygrapher to come in and testify to the truth of the matter asserted, so to speak, to testify to the fact of the results, to have an opinion. It's not a compulsory process. What was going on in Kolbeck is what's going on in Rock, which is to say the right of the accused to explain the circumstances. And there's an analogy, it's a great analogy in Wheeler to 8033 and other hearsay rules.
I had always thought that the point of Sheffer was to say that this evidence is not sufficiently reliable, right, to be admitted to either show that the person was telling the truth or to show the person was lying. And moreover, that would also interfere with the fact finder's ability or duty to discern those
Yes, sir, I think that's right. I think that's right. Now, the last part of that is in the Schaeffer opinion is in 2B, so that's technically not part of the holding of the court, but it's also a perfectly valid point. There's a great line in there, I think it's a quote from another case, that says the jury is the lie detector, not the bells and whistles in the machine. So the polygraph fails Daubert. We have no problem with that. We have no problem with Schaeffer. But there is a material distinction. It's just like in hearsay, where there's a difference between saying, I want the result in. And looking at the rules, it's interesting, Your Honor, in terms of what do you bring to the text? All the deconstructionists are obsessed with this. Is it the text only, or is it context? What is the context that you bring in? And the people who look at this a lot, who know the history, are influenced by that. And a critic might say, well, if that's you know, their view, their reading of the rule is corrupted by this outside knowledge, but perhaps it's informed by that. The California origin of it, the purpose of the rule, as mentioned in the drafter's analysis at 822-60, shows that the heart of the rule is the scientific evidence rule. That's what was talked about in Schaeffer. That was the basis of the Schaeffer decision. That was the basis of having the rule in the first place. And the reason that matters here, if we're asking the constitutional question, does the Constitution say that on these facts, the rule has to yield to the Constitution? The constitutional standard that is clearly announced in these cases is the rule cannot be disproportionate to the purposes. So if the purposes of the rule, if the purpose of the rule was this scientific purpose, and that's what California, the people, for what it's worth, the people who wrote this, that's what they thought it meant. And
what
it was
weighty interest of your client was infringed upon by the judge's interpretation of this rule in this case?
Your Honor, in this case, the argument for coercion, the 304 type argument to attack the weight, was not very strong. Everyone was fixated on this idea of voluntariness. At trial, the judge basically only decided on voluntariness. At the Army Corps, they're still fixated on voluntariness. But there's also, I could challenge the weight of somebody's testimony, whether it's the accused or anybody else, by saying, what is this person's ability to perceive and recall? And if the witness has said previously many times, I don't remember what happened, I don't know what happened. Other people say he was intoxicated, there's a breathalyzer. So the weight that it deserves, this is a strong case about deception. And that's how the government gets to use polygraphs, apparently in the Air Force, that seems to be, according to the service court, what they allow. If I say I was coerced, the Air Force trial counsel can call, that it can ask the agent, well, you know, isn't it true that you actually changed your statement not because you were coerced, but because we gave you this legal manipulation, you failed the poly and you fessed up. And that's the rule in federal court. It's a 403 analysis, and the question is asked in the federal courts in this 403 analysis, and this is mentioned in Gaines, the Air Force case, the 403 analysis is the proponent trying to smuggle in the bad science, or are they really making a point about the circumstances? And so in federal court, if I attack the statement or the voluntariness of the statement or otherwise challenge the quality, then the government can mention this. Here the defense should have been allowed to mention this because the language game that was played was key. If I say I don't remember, then you could give me a polygraph. If it has to be a yes or no question, do you remember? That is a yes or no question. You could test me using this polygraph on that. They refused to do so, Your Honor.
Doesn't that potentially cause some problems in terms of if the claim simply is that, and as appellant had stated at one point in the course of the trial, this really hurt. Now, we don't have to credit that assertion, but that's what he stated. It really hurt. On a scale of 1 to 10, it was an 8 in terms of pain. And I just wanted this to be over. That's what he said. I just wanted out, and the way to do this was to tell them whatever they wanted. That doesn't implicate the results of the polygraph at all. But in terms of the path you're going down, where then the assertion is, well, the polygraph indicated that you were deceptive, doesn't that cause more problems because we're getting down to the results of the polygraph? Doesn't that stray into Schaeffer?
It does, Your Honor, but that is, again, focused more toward the coercion aspect, which is not the most compelling and important attack on the reliability, there's also the question of the deceptive nature, and the polygraph examiner seems to sincerely believe, so far as we can tell from the record, the polygraph examiner seemed to believe somehow for some reason that he could not test this question of, do you remember? And I think this is in the reply brief at 4 and 5, how the polygraph examiner set up the question so that necessarily there would be this failure of the test and its pressure on someone to adopt, basically, what the appellant did is he adopted the statements of the other people. And there's a strange echo of this in the trial. There was an error in the trial procedure, which in a guilty plea, it's not fatal necessarily, but it's interesting that it happened the same way at trial. The trial judge told the accused, answer the questions as if you remember. This is the same thing that's going on in the polygraph. And the polygraph ended the trial, instead of saying, this is what happened, and the accused says, I accept that that's true. I accept that I must have done that. They are getting him to say he did it.
But in terms of the CCA analysis, they were essentially saying you could have taken this other course, could have cited to the other evidence. When it comes to the issue of, well, they told me I was lying, that could have been done without any invocation of the polygraph, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
In terms of them saying, you have to tell us either yes or no. Can't say I don't remember. That could have been done without any reference to the results of the polygraph. But in terms of saying, I was hooked up to a machine that really hurt me, that's where it's inextricably linked to having evidence come in about the polygraph. That's my concern is, in terms of, with the first two points I raised, we're straying into Sheffer. But are we really straying into Sheffer at all with the last point, about getting to, I was in pain, the only reasonable explanation would be it was in the course of a polygraph exam.
Yeah, that is true, but also at the second juncture with the idea of not being able to answer, I don't know, it's one thing to say that. I could say that I was in a conversation with someone and the person would not accept my claim that I did not remember. But it gives more of an understandable, a relatable something that people would appreciate. Oh, I see how that could happen that way. If you understand that you have a person who is intimidated by the process, who is told by the examiner he's hooked up, you have this mystique of the machine, and so this it adds weight and authority to the idea that I don't remember is not a valid answer.
Colonel Carey, I see you down to 2 minutes. Could you focus on prejudice, please? Let's say that, in fact, this evidence had come in about the circumstances of the polygraph, not the results of that. And let's say that it was so effective that it completely vitiated any evidentiary value of the statement, the confession, the admissions of the accused. Wasn't the whole point here the intent of the accused? Because didn't the accused, in the course of the trial, make admissions in regard to actually touching the victim in this case? So when it comes down to intent, why wouldn't we find that it was legally sufficient in terms of there was no prejudice in regard to the intent issue?
Your Honor, the question for an error of constitutional dimension is whether it contributed. And in this case, with regard to guilt itself and the degree of culpability, you have here the distinction between someone who may have done something when he was non compos mentis or someone who knows.
Well, the defense expert in cross-examination by the government conceded that someone who is blacked out can still form intent.
Yes, Your Honor.
And then what you have for intent is A, the actions, and B, the statement of the accused at the time of the offense, saying, do you want me?
What?
So why, looking at that, can't we say, well, the intent was demonstrated here?
Your Honor, with regard to the statement of the of the defense expert. Your Honor, I'm about to run out of time, if I may.
Please answer the question.
That actual statement that could form intent, it's really up to the decide. The trier fact should be the one deciding that rather than experts, just as we don't have a polygraph examiner come in and usurp that role. The expert is not really the person who should answer the legal conclusion of whether it was. But in terms of the mental processes and the idea of knowing what he's doing, it is possible that he could be in a blackout state, but again, and form intent. But again, going to whether he was guilty and the degree of culpability, is he only guilty of the lesser offense or not guilty of a crime at all, does depend on his mental state. And by getting him to say, I did this, as though he remembered doing it, throwing cold water on this, now he doesn't even have the benefit of any reduced capacity, this is absolutely prejudicial. The government, when they needed to attack this, when they were scorning the intoxication defense, said, and this is the Joint Appendix of 393, after sort of critiquing this, said, you'd have to ignore his whole confession. So that is what the trial counsel at trial relies on, is you have this statement, the gold standard in criminal law, confessing, saying that he did know what he was doing. That absolutely torpedoes then any argument that he doesn't, and this should have been decided by the trier of fact. I see I'm out of time. Subject to your
questions. Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the government.
Chief Judge Stuckey, judges of the court, may it please the court, I'm Captain Brian Jones, and with Captain Jeremy Watford, I represent the United States. The military judge did not abuse his discretion, and his reasonable application of MRE 707 did not prevent appellant from testifying in his own words to challenge the reliability of his allegedly false confession.
Okay. Would you agree that this polygrapher, or whatever you want to call him, engaged in a bit of sharp practice when he administered this thing?
Certainly, Your Honor. I mean, he
lied.
He lied to him, yes. And
he lied.
I think that's...
Well, having lied, what is the accused supposed to do? If the rule precludes him from showing that he lied.
Your Honor, the rule precludes...
The rule precludes any mention of it, as I think I got out of counsel for the appellant. You
right.
Can't talk about it. Fine. Straightforward interpretation of its words. So what's he supposed to do?
Your Honor, he could nevertheless present substantial factual evidence at the trial, as he did at the motions hearing, explaining why he wrote the confession that day, specifically that he was Special Agent RR would not accept his answers, that he said he claimed he did not remember any of the key events, that he was told by Special Agent RR that he had to answer yes or no, and among other things that the Army Court noted in its opinion, presenting this substantial factual evidence.
What about the pain?
Your Honor, I think there were two sources of pain that appellant testified to. He had his profile for bilateral hip pain, which I believe was documented and noted by the military judge in his factual findings, that he experienced just from sitting. And then there was a pain in his hand that he suffered from. He testified the blood pressure cuff. So it could have testified about both sets of pain, about the...
How do you testify about pain in your hand from a blood pressure cuff from a polygraph and not mention a polygraph?
Your Honor, I think... Referencing pain, and I agree he would not have been able to discuss the source of the pain, but he would have been able to. The pain itself is not.
I was subjected to something which caused me, by the government, which caused me pain, and whatever. But I can't tell you what it is.
Your Honor, the government acknowledges that MRE 707 precluded some of the elements.
I think it precludes the whole thing by its terms, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, yes. Appellant taking a polygraph examination, evidence of appellant's desire
to polygraph. So he's supposed to have just been floating off here in space, experiencing pain, and being told by some entity that he can't not remember. I don't know where that leaves him.
Your Honor,
I'm asking the government to tell me where that leaves him.
Your Honor, the fact that he was told that he could not, that he was told that he couldn't answer yes or no, or that he had to answer.
It's a lie.
Right. And that, yes, Your Honor.
It was a lie.
Correct, Your Honor.
Right. Go ahead.
And that the government would not, or that Special Agent R in this case would not accept his answer that he couldn't remember. Yes, this evidence was not precluded from the military judge's application of 707. He would have been able to present this at trial to, if he elected to do so, or through a cross-examination of Special Agent RR, which, as it turns out, only spanned three pages in the record of trial and didn't discuss the interrogation at all. But
again, he can't.
Sir, I think his techniques can, Your Honor. I don't believe that military rule of evidence
707. Well, you'd have to be a better cross-examiner than I am to slide that in, but go ahead.
Chief Judge Stuckey, I think when the government is presenting, for example, post-polygraph confessions, there's always a bit of witness preparation and tiptoeing around the polygraph issue. So it's not impossible to prepare a witness or to prepare a cross-examination such that it doesn't stray into this category. And to the extent appellant or appellant's counsel believe that MRE 707 or the judge's application of that rule in this case is not error attributable to the military judge.
Did appellant ever say that the reason that he confessed was because he took the polygraph?
No, he did. No, Your Honor, I don't believe it is. I believe the argument.
I mean, if that had been the situation, you'd agree that this would be a different case, right?
I think that's right, Judge Ryan, and that's really, I think that's more of the argument that was made in Wheeler about it was the polygraph, the inducement, the fact that he was misled, or he testified that he was misled about the use of the polygraph. There was much more of a causal connection there between the polygraph, the machine, the way the agent talked to him about what was going to happen with the results of the machine, that, and you're going to present it to his command and whatnot, that really induced the confession.
Counsel, I'm looking at my notes here, coming from the JA, and he was asked whether you had any recollection of the events, why would you confess? And he said, quote, because I felt that's exactly what they wanted. I kept saying I didn't know. He was going to hook me back to the machine, and we were going to have to do more rounds of the polygraph, indicating that is why he confessed. So I'm not sure what distinction you're drawing there, saying that the accused did not tie it into the polygraph.
Your Honor, absolutely. I think he mentioned several reasons at the motions hearing, that he wanted to leave, he thought that's what they wanted to hear, he was in pain, and he
wanted to get out of that. So.
Correct, Your Honor. He did not want to do any more polygraph examinations. Acknowledge that. And he stated that, and there's no reason not to believe that. He didn't want to be hooked up to the machine again. I think that's very different, though, than a situation where an accused is told that, you know, we have these results of the polygraph, they're going to be given to your command, is misled about those results, and then adopts the answers of the polygraph as his confession. In this case, after appellant was confronted with the deceptive polygraph results for 20 to 25 minutes, he maintained to Special Agent RR precisely what he had maintained before the polygraph, that he could not remember any of the key events. It was not as if immediately upon hearing the polygraph that he believed the machine and adopted the answers and confessed accordingly.
Counsel, can I draw your attention to a point that the appellant made in the reply brief, which was that in your brief you mentioned the government's interest in excluding the results of a polygraph, but you never really mentioned or described the government's interest in excluding the fact that somebody took a polygraph. What is the government's interest?
Your Honor, even presenting the fact that at a court-martial that someone took a polygraph, I think once you ring that bell, it brings with it all kinds of inferences. Someone took a polygraph, yet we're still here today. litigating this person's guilt. So they must have, you know, perhaps they failed the polygraph. I think it that the rule is a broad, bright-line rule of exclusion, certainly based on the reliability.
But why couldn't a military judge simply instruct the members, and we have to assume that the members would follow the instruction, that they should draw no conclusions from the fact that a polygraph was conducted here?
Your Honor, I think the easy answer to that is because MRA 707 prohibits the reference to taking.
Constitutional rights supersede a military rule of evidence.
Absolutely, Your Honor. The Constitution is not subordinate to military rule of evidence.
So then what do you do with Crane versus Kentucky that was specifically talked about the fact that stripped of the power to describe to the jury the circumstances, the defendant is effectively disabled from answering the one question they want to know, and that is, if the defendant is innocent, then why did he previously admit to the offense? So there's the constitutional interest that's out there. So why is that somehow subordinated to a military rule of evidence?
Your Honor, I think the Supreme Court in Sheffer, in going through cases like Rock, like Chambers, like Washington, it really distinguishes the constitutional concern at play in those cases versus the constitutional concern in this case. Consider a case like Rock, where the defendant was accused of murder, was without being under hypnosis, could not testify at all about any of the factual evidence to present her defense. In this case, however, the appellant was not, number one, was not precluded from testifying about anything that happened at the house that night. And even notwithstanding the judge's application of MRE 707, was still not precluded from presenting substantial factual evidence concerning the circumstances around the polygraph. Again, could not discuss the polygraph itself, but there was evidence that he could have presented. And that's where I believe the Supreme Court, you know, in showing its work in those three constitutional cases, found that this is quite a different, this limitation is not arbitrary or disproportionate to the purposes that it serves.
Counsel, can I switch gears a little bit on this? In his dissent in Sheffer, Justice Stevens said that, sort of chided this court, saying before reaching the constitutional issue, maybe this court should have first considered whether the president had legal authority under Article 36 to create this rule. And so my question is, do the rules of evidence generally recognized in the trial of criminal cases in the United States district courts exclude evidence that somebody took a polygraph as opposed to the results of the evidence?
Your Honor, I believe in my research on this, that was, I believe the Fourth Circuit still has a per se ban. I don't know specifically on if that's narrower than MRE 707, for example, if they could talk about just merely taking a polygraph. I believe many states still have per se bans. Other circuits allow it in if it's stipulated to. But I don't think in the 20 years that have intervened since Sheffer that there's been a watershed movement in concern about the reliability and the prejudicial effect of this particular kind of.
Can I ask you this related question? I think that this gets to Judge Maggs's question. Is there a federal rule of evidence like MRE 707?
There is not, Your Honor. There's not a per se rule of exclusion for polygraph evidence in the federal rules. So in that respect, certainly a military unique rule. And Article 36 does say so far as.
Can you speak to why there would be a need for a unique military rule?
The need, I mean, as mentioned by the drafters, Your Honor, I think it was, I mean, the policy concerns. Preventing this unreliable and prejudicial evidence, preserving the jury's role, and avoiding collateral litigation in a worldwide UCMJ jurisdiction litigating the qualifications of a polygrapher, or litigating the machine in every trial.
Why wouldn't Daubert? I'm sorry.
But that would go to the point of whether the results were admissible, right? Not whether the surrounding circumstances or the fact that one was taken. Because that doesn't implicate Daubert, does it? So it's sort of like hearsay, right? We're not offering the polygraph to show that he was telling the truth or that he was lying, but rather for purpose X or Y or Z. Why would that be problematic?
Did you say why would not?
Why? I said, why would that be problematic in the military in a way that it wouldn't be problematic anywhere?
Just mere, even even a I believe even referencing the taking of a polygraph as, and I believe I said this in response to Judge Olds' question, but just having the jury hear that, I think it brings with it the inferences. He took a polygraph, yet we're still here in this court martial to say.
I mean, and maybe I'm not understanding Judge Maggs's question, but I think I am, which is, if it isn't a rule of evidence for federal district courts, what's a justification for it being a rule for the military?
Your Honor, I would have to defer to the drafter's analysis and the advice that he got from his...
Was this a member's trial?
This was United States versus Colbeck with Judge Alone, Your Honor. Right.
So what are the concerns about confusing the jury or taking the role away from them?
Your Honor, MRE 707 does not, you know, it doesn't distinguish between whether a case goes to the members or goes to, it's tried by Judge Alone. As this court's case in United States versus Clark at 53 MJ 280, this court found that a military judge committed plain error by admitting polygraph evidence in a stipulation of fact that was presumably signed off on by the trial counsel, defense counsel, and the defendant. So all parties were okay with it. Nevertheless, this court determined error otherwise.
And along the same lines, what interest of the state, the government, is vindicated through 707 that wouldn't be vindicated through a Dobert analysis? When Judge Maggs is citing the fact that there are no federal, or in response to his questions, you're saying there's no federal similar provision, why wouldn't Dobert and the military cover the same point in terms of Sheffer talking about the weighty state interest being unreliable evidence should not come into court-martial? Why shouldn't that be sufficient rather than having 707 on the books?
Your Honor, it's not that Dobert and treating it like other scientific evidence is not a reasonable option for other U.S. district courts, but it's what Sheffer found, and even in Justice Kennedy's concurrence there, is that it's not unreasonable, given the legitimate policy concerns of the president, to treat it as a per se rule of exclusion. It's not that two things can be true at once. It can be okay to do it this way, and it can be okay to treat it as other states do, a per se ban, entered only through stipulation, or like many federal circuits do and treat it as other scientific evidence. That may be a valid way to do it, and certainly the president can change MRE 707 if he elects to treat it that way, Your Honor. Turning to the prejudice in this case, the government would submit that even if the military judge abused his discretion, that any error was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt in light of the strength of the government's case, which centered on a 14-year-old girl who testified that appellant touched her breast, touched her buttocks, and nibbled on her hair after saying, "Do you want me?" As the Army Court found, and the government would agree with that, the appellant's actions that night, the only reasonable explanation for his actions is his specific sexual intent. To enter the bedroom, has the wherewithal to lie down next to her, to commit these sexual acts, and then after she, age, gets into bed with KG, appellant's daughter, he leaves the room, and then later returns to the room, finds that the door is locked, jiggles it, as testified to by age, or by KG, and then finds a way to unlock the door and enter the room again, sees that she, age, is now in bed with KG, and then leaves the room. Not disputing that appellant was intoxicated on the night in question, but the voluntary intoxication, although evidence was presented on that, it did not sufficiently negate what appellant's actions clearly demonstrated, which was his desire to gratify his sexual intent. Pending any further questions of the court,
counsel, can I ask one further question? Again, this is I want to get hear your side on the issue that the appellant brought up, which is that this isn't really a case about the voluntariness of the confession, but instead a case about the ability to perceive and recall what he said. Do you agree with that characterization? In other words, that even if the statement was in some sense voluntary, that the circumstances cast doubt on the believability of it based on the ability to perceive and recall.
Yes, Judge Madge, I think that's fair. That appellant wanted to testify that he didn't even allege law enforcement coercion or anything like that, that they overbore his will in this particular instance to get his confession. But I think challenging the circumstances was what he sought to do in this case. He wanted the polygraph evidence to do that, but notwithstanding the judge's ruling, he could have challenged the reliability of his confession with substantial factual evidence, but elected to pursue the strategy of voluntary intoxication, which the government would submit was not mutually exclusive with his the voluntary intox defense was not mutually exclusive with also challenging the reliability of his confession. Pending any further questions of the court.
Thank you, counsel. Don't have rebuttal.
Your Honor, first addressing the centrality of the polygraph to the statement that he made, the judge read a portion from the Joint Appendix at 87, and the continuation is in the same vein. In fact, there's another line of great importance in that examination where the witness said, this is the appellant talking about the polygraph examiner, he told me that if I continued to say that, that he would have to hook me back up to the machine and we would have to go more rounds. So in that very direct sense, the polygraph, the appellant did assert at trial that this was the reason. And at trial, the trial defense counsel absolutely argued Wheeler and argued the heart of Wheeler, which is to say a constitutional exception to the rule. It's in the joint appendix at 127, 135, and 136, and at 144. Your Honor, next I'd like to give a more thorough answer to the question on the federal court approach, because the federal district courts, they don't have 707, but they do have Daubert. I submit that this case, actually let me step back, Sheffer would have gone exactly the same way under Daubert without 707. At trial, he says, I want to bring in a polygraph expert to testify and give this opinion. The judge says, no, you failed Daubert. He appeals, maybe he wins here, maybe he wins there, whatever. But the case is, it's the same thing. That is the same outcome. The federal courts have, and this is in Tenorio is a Tenth Circuit case from 2015, and at 809 F3rd 1130, continuing on to 31, the court said, the circuits have uniformly held, before and after Daubert, that when the defendant opens the door to polygraph evidence, such as attacking the nature of the investigation, of course, now I'm paraphrasing, it becomes a 403 question. And also on 1103 in that case, there is an example of a limiting instruction. They give in that case the limiting instruction that was given. Similarly, in the Air Force Court of Gaines, so we have a military case, 20 MJ, and the page number is 669, where they mention the limiting instruction. So in the Air Force and in the federal courts, the question of admissibility is determined by a 403 analysis. Is this an attempt to smuggle in bad science? Is this actually going to the purpose of the rule? And I return to that phrase, to the purpose of the rule, because that is what Rock and Sheffer say the constitutional standard is. Is it disproportionate to the purpose of the rule? So it really is a question of as applied. And in Sheffer, in that section, only 2A and 2D are the opinion of the court. And in 2D, they return to this, and they have this comparison paragraph. It's a great paragraph, read in context, that saying here the court members heard the relevant details and the rule did not preclude defendant from introducing any factual evidence. And then Justice Thomas attaches a footnote to the term factual evidence to distinguish between bringing in some polygraph opinion versus the right of the accused, as in Rock, to testify.
Can I interrupt you for just a minute before your time runs out? Just so I understand kind of the posture of the case. The accused ended up pleading guilty to the assault and battery part of the offenses. And so is he now saying that all of these circumstances that occurred surrounding the taking of the polygraph made me admit to my intent? Is that what's going on? What's he saying now? Just so I'm clear.
Yes, Your Honor.
If intent was the only issue at the contested part of the trial, is he now saying, hey, look, I did all these physical acts, however, the circumstances surrounding the polygraph is what made me admit that my intent was criminal. Is that it?
Yes, Your Honor. It's, okay. It's exactly it. And it is on that point that the confession is the gold standard. And this other circumstantial evidence, in any sexual case, things like greed, lust, these things, we don't really need someone to come in and explain motive in a case that involves greed or lust. Circumstantial evidence usually suffices. But when you have that statement just displaces all of that, and it shows a greater degree of culpability, because now you don't have someone who doesn't know what he's doing. You have someone who knows perfectly well what he is doing, and the egregiousness of that is much greater. And, Your Honor, in mentioning sharp practice, the comparison with Sheffer with Wheeler is perfect. In Wheeler, the lie was, we can use this. In this case, the lie was, I can't test on this thing. It's deception. And in both cases, it inhibited his right to testify in his own defense. So it's the representation, self-representation, as in Rock. Sam, my time is expiring, if I could finish the phrase, Your Honor. So the comparison is important because under Rock and under this case, Colbeck, we're talking about the Sixth Amendment right to be heard in your own words and to explain the circumstances in which the statement is given. That does not implicate the purposes of the rule, and so the rule is disproportionate as applied if it prohibits that.
Thank you, counsel. Court thanks counsel for both sides. Case is now submitted, and the court is in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.
The court is adjourned until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.